Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, January 31st. We hope everyone is drying out after the wind and rain hit the state. We check in on Molokai's transportation woes, either by air or sea, and hear how residents are going the distance to try and make it work. We continue to hear from new leaders at the helm of our critical social service agencies after an unsettling start to the week. And we consider challenges in the nonprofit world as community organizations throughout the state navigate the shifting politics in the nation's capital. Plus a half a century of service in the classroom, we hear from an educator who's had a lifetime of helping to nurture minds and souls. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The storm front that swept through the islands grounded flights for a time yesterday and made for a rough ocean going for vessels on the water. And that's some of what residents of Molokai have been dealing with of late. Here to talk about their transportation woes is HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Are you dry?
It's cleared up a little bit over here on Molokai. Still some rain, but the wind has died down, so we were out of power for about 6 hours yesterday. Glad to have everything somewhat back up and running.
Yes, but the problem with transportation is still a big one for residents there. So what do you have for us today?
Yes, that issue is very much not resolved, unfortunately. So a couple weeks ago on January 15th, Mokulele shut down operations for about a week. And they cited maintenance issues and an abundance of caution. And it was never really clear what exactly caused the shutdown. They're still not back to full capacity. And so Molokai residents are taking fishing boats to their medical appointments on Maui and Oahu. And, you know, this is not just because of weather. This is just ongoing cancellations as the airline tries to get back up and running after this issue. And, you know, not only taking fishing boats to Oahu, but sometimes, you know, the water is so rough and it's a long ride to get to Oahu. So if they have to get there, sometimes they'll take a boat to Mala Wharf on Maui and catch a ride to Kahului and then get on another airline to make it to Oahu. And so it's been a real struggle for residents. You know, this isn't a new issue, but the last few weeks have certainly been a lot worse. Yesterday, I talked with Desiree Naioli. She and her husband own a 30-foot boat and have been among the many Molokai boat captains who've been stepping up to help the community in recent weeks to get to where they need to go. During the storm yesterday, they took a pregnant woman to Maui for her medical appointment after her flight was canceled, crossed the Pailolo Channel in really stormy, you know, this rainy weather. They've been transporting doctors and nurses to serve Molokai during the flight cancellations, medical patients, you know, of course, with off-island appointments, residents with mainland flights. And so this has been, you know, they've alone have been doing 2 to 3 boat runs a day whenever they're able to.
Wow.
Many other boat captains are as well. So it's really, you know, we talk about coming up with solutions and Molokai is kind of coming up with their own way to be resilient and still get to where we need to go. Captains immediately stepped up, you know, as soon as Mokulele announced the shutdown and, you know, offered rides. And Naioli says she's willing to keep doing them, you know, doing runs as long as it's needed. You know, she said the need is continuing on. Lorelei Rollins-Crivello is from Molokai, but lives mostly on Oahu now because of her own son's medical needs, but she shared a story with me about a family member on Molokai whose one-year-old had to get to Oahu for treatments in preparation for a kidney transplant.
When the shutdown happened last week, they got told the flight was canceled and there was no alternatives for them. So they rebooked it for this week. And then yesterday, they got canceled again. And we were under the understanding that possibly with some of the flights that they are flying, they would accommodate those with medical needs as a priority. She had called and shared her story that her baby needs to come for treatment and, you know, for his kidney transplant, but they had no resolve. Like, we were like, just keep calling. And we all know that when we have appointments on Oahu, you don't just reschedule. Sometimes it takes months to even get to see the specialist again. So they put the boat in the water in Kaunakakai Pier and came straight to Oahu across the Ka'iwi. I've crossed the Ka'iwi on an average day, and it's not a fun channel to cross. And it was a really windy day for them with a sick baby. They came across, made it to their appointment, did however long the treatments were. They were still on Oahu at 3:30, knowing that they would have to go back across the Ka'iwi to get home on boat. It takes a good 3 to 4 hours. So leaving Oahu maybe 3:30, 4 o'clock, you know that they're getting into Molokai 6:30, 7 o'clock. It's dark already. The fear is that we have patients already sick having to endure these conditions that just to go and get treatments, just to go see specialists on Oahu. And that's so unacceptable. For essential medical needs, we gotta have some kind of alternative for our families.
Gosh, our hearts just go out to them for having to go through that ordeal on top of an illness.
Absolutely. And, you know, I talked with Lori Lay day before yesterday. And so this was before the weather, you know, any weather cancellations that may have happened yesterday. You know, and everybody understands weather cancellations. And, you know, even Rollins Caravello, you know, said she doesn't solely blame Mokulele. You know, there's so many issues here. Definitely no one blames airport staff for these delays. You know, they deal with a lot of frustration as well. And no one blames the airline for wanting to be safe and, you know, do necessary maintenance. But I think part of the frustration is this is the second time recently that Mokulele has shut down for maintenance issues. They were closed for 3 days in August for, you know, something similar. We're not exactly sure what. And so, you know, that on top of just ongoing reliability issues, frequent delays and cancellations, even when there are no maintenance issues, has definitely built up a lot of frustration for Molokai as well as Lanai residents. And, you know, Mokulele, I will say, I reached out to them several times for requests for information on, you know, what the cause was or when they might be back up to full operations, and they didn't get back to me. So, you know, looking at solutions, Maui County is considering a publicly funded ferry, and that is something that Lanai Council Member Gabe Johnson talked with me about and shared some updates with what's happening.
The feasibility study will be published in February, which is just next month. I'll have a meeting in my ADEPT committee to discuss it at some point. And then the council will discuss budget deliberations in April. So right now, waiting for that feasibility study to come out, then we discuss the budget. And my understanding is the administration, the mayor's administration, is on board, no pun intended, on purchasing the ferry. So hopefully they would put it in the budget as a line item and say X amount of dollars to purchase the Expeditions ferry, the Maui Lanai ferry. The way it stands, I really feel confident that the administration will put in a line item in the budget to purchase it. Our calendar is July 1st is when the fiscal year starts. So the administration would have the money to purchase the ferry from Expeditions. And the way we would do that is we would probably buy the vessels and then contract out the operators. We do the exact same thing with our Maui County buses. The buses are owned by the Maui County, but Roberts of Hawaii are in contract to drive the bus. So the bus driver, in fact, is a Roberts of Hawaii employee. We would do the same thing for the ferry. Now, the important thing about why it's so good for the county to own a ferry is because that accesses us to federal funds. Private companies cannot access these funds. And then, so there's a lot of pots of money where we could improve our harbors. And then we could also go and ask the feds, hey, we want to extend a run between Maui and Molokai. Here's our plans for the boat, and we just need the funds. The feds would give us the funds to do that.
You know, we did just have a Congressman Jill Takuda on the show this week, and she talked about having to go to the neighbor islands, right, to meet her constituents, and the difficulty about getting on a boat and an airplane. And, I know, you know, her heart is, in doing whatever she can to make sure that that lifeline, you know, is in place for residents out there.
Absolutely. I think, you know, a number of different folks are working on it from so many different angles. I did reach out to the U.S. Department of Transportation. They are in charge of Mokulele's essential air service contracts. And Mokulele does have several essential air service contracts in Hawaii, one of which was recently awarded to Lanai. And the USDOT told me that they're monitoring the situation closely. They're reviewing Mokulele's compliance with these contracts. They're required to provide a certain number of flights daily to these communities. And the DOT said if the EAS carrier can't meet the terms of those contracts, that the DOT, you know, may terminate the contract and initiate a new carrier selection process to provide flights for that community. So they're also you know, checking it out on their end. And Pacific Air Charters is another company. They didn't return my call, but my understanding is they have another year or so during which they're working to get FAA certifications in order to be able to expand their service for scheduled flights. And so their goal is to also be able to provide another option for residents to these neighbor island communities.
And then I don't know if you know the answer to this, but, you know, given the experience of the super ferry and the pushback that some in the Molokai community, you know, made clear. And I know recently there was, a billionaire's yacht that was that tried to come into port or was, you know, offshore there. And there was some concern about that. I mean, any sense about what the community thinks about a ferry service run by the county?
So I think there's a lot of support for the county ferry. And, you know, even Gabe Johnson made it clear that this is not a super ferry, different goal. You know, this is specifically for the residents of Molokai and Lanai. And Molokai won't, sounds like, initially be included just because of Lahaina's harbor situation. Trip to Ma'alaya, he said, you know, would take a lot longer ferry ride. And so in the interim, while the Lahaina Harbor is being renovated and replaced after the fire, you know, looking at alternatives and maybe a little bit delayed initial start for Molokai to have a ferry, which they would also need to purchase a new ferry to serve between Molokai and Maui. So a lot of factors to consider, but he did make it clear that it would not be a super ferry. It would be very similar to the service that previously ran between the islands and continues to run between Maui and Lanai.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine. We'll see how this plays out.
Thank you so much.
That was HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel talking to us about transportation issues on Molokai. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
O Hawaii.
We are swimming through the music library in search of the Rockabilly Hall of Famer, whose local hit, Susie Darlin, sold more than a million copies worldwide. Do you remember hearing this on the radio? The song was written and recorded in 1958 when our mystery musician was attending Punahou School. It was all the rage on Hawaii radio rotations. The song's popularity even caught the ear of national label Dot Records, which bought his recording contract and the international master tapes. However, success was fleeting and our mystery musician quit the entertainment business in 1965. For our quiz today, can you name this teen heartthrob who titled his song for his then 5-year-old sister? Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. Pick up a reusable HPR tote bag if you're the first one to get it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services. NareitHawaii.com.
HPR celebrates the life of our former president and general manager and my dear friend, Jose Fajardo. Join me, Ray Cruz, for a special 2-hour Latin Beat tribute. Get ready to dance and have fun, because it's what Jose would have wanted. Join me this evening at 8 p.m. here on HPR 1. See you then.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater, presenting The World of Wong Kar-wai, with films including In the Mood for Love through February 2nd. HonoluluMuseum.org.
For the first time in its 77-year history, Catholic Charities Hawaii has its first woman and first Native Hawaiian leader at the helm. Tina Andrade joined us in studio yesterday afternoon to talk about the challenges ahead, given the scare about a freeze on federal funding on which many nonprofits rely. Andrade is a graduate of Kamehameha Schools in Chaminade University and has worked behind the scenes at the organization for more than 2 decades.
I've had a long love relationship with Catholic Charities Hawaii. I love our mission and our values, and I think just bringing the knowledge and the history and the culture of the organization, but also my love for Hawaii. I was born and raised here, and so the islands mean a lot to me. And I think just the care and concern for the mission that we do for the people of Hawaii here. And for us who are a part of Hawaii, connection is very important. And so I think what I can bring is that spirit of lokahi, of being connected to other people to work in a united way to try to solve today's issues.
And, you know, so many families are struggling these days. And growing up, you had struggles too.
Yes. You know, my parents were married very young, and they were divorced by the time I was 2. So my mother had to work 2 jobs to make a living. And she met my dad when I was 12. And so even on 2 incomes, my dad had to work a 2nd job to make ends meet. And, you know, when I graduated from high school, I worked 2 jobs as well. I didn't go to college right away. I started in the hospitality industry and eventually found my way to Catholic Charities Hawaii. So I definitely understand the struggle of trying to make ends meet in the island, and that problem continues today and is probably even getting worse because the cost of housing is so high.
And so when you see the programs that Catholic Charities has in place to help the houseless or to help families in need, you know that is real.
Yes, it is a blessing to be able to do this service, to be here for the community. And, you know, we have programs that span the range from keiki to kupuna. We have over 40 programs that help people in Hawaii dealing with some very important issues. You know, we help to keep families safe. Many of the families, because they're so income constrained, it puts a lot of stress, mental health issues on families, and we're there for them to help them to really feel like somebody's on their side and to help them to develop skills so that they can do better.
And so tell us where Catholic Charities is at with some of the housing projects.
Well, we have a lot of housing assistance. We have financial assistance. We also help them with financial literacy. We help them with case management. Depending on, you know, where they are and what their needs are, we have ways to help lift them up. But in addition to the housing services, we also have our affordable housing work. After working with people in the community for so many years, so many people were coming for financial assistance because they just couldn't afford the rental amounts. And as you know, that's just getting worse. And so we decided to get into the business of affordable housing. We were just able to complete our 300 units at Mehe'ula Vista in Mililani. And we were also able to build a senior housing facility in Kahului. That's completed now. And then we're excited about Hale Pilina, which is a new family housing in Kahului, Maui. And what's great about that is even though it's in Kahului, it's not in Lahaina. We know that there's a lot of housing that's needed for the people in Lahaina, but it's at least increasing the housing stock. We'll have 178 more units that will help to alleviate some of the strain in the Maui housing situation.
Housing was tough before the wildfires,
yes,
but even
was.
Worse
yes.
after that.
Yes. And, you know, in addition to housing, you know, what we often don't talk about is the mental health issue of it. For the people in Lahaina, some of them lost their lives, of course. You know, some of them lost their jobs as well, but they also lost a community and a way of living. And I think a lot of times people feel that, well, we've helped for several months, they've gotten financial assistance, they should be able to get back on their feet. But the reality is they're having to rebuild their entire lives. In some ways, it's even their identity. Many of the families were separated because large families were living together. And, you know, they had to separate because they had to look for whatever accommodations were available. And, you know, I don't know if people realize that some people have moved over 20 times in this period. I talked to one young girl who said that she had moved 16 times, and that was over a year ago. So if you could imagine just the instability in those families, for them to get back to full-time work and thriving, it's going to be a journey for them. And so we're there to help in the mental health area, too. We have services in Lahaina, and we also have a support center in Wailuku for those who are helping the helpers.
Well, you know, I recall interviewing a survivor, and she wanted to thank the firefighters who came to her rescue.
Yes.
And there needs to be healing on both sides, because that was very traumatic for our firefighters, our first
yes.
responders. And so, yeah, anything we can do to help them as well.
Yes. And, you know, we often don't think about them. They're so busy helping other people. They're not taking care of their own mental health needs. And so case managers, teachers, and of course, first responders, firefighters. We did our dedication just recently, and Chief Hanley was there, and they're just so grateful that we're there for them in the community.
And then isn't there a project downtown as well that you're working on?
We're still looking at that. I think you're talking about Hale Kamiano, just looking at the possibility of what we can do with that property, but that's still in early discussion.
Okay, early talks, yeah. So what is it that you want people to know about Catholic Charities and the climate that we're in, because it's been an interesting week?
Well, it's been a flurry. It's been quite a turbulent week. But, you know, Catholic Charities has been here for 77 years. We have over 50 programs helping people from Keiki to Kupuna. And we can help people with a wide variety of needs, mental health needs, youth who are challenged, helping develop skills so that they can be successful adults. We have, of course, our housing programs. And, you know, we help a lot of families to be strengthened so that they can be stabilized and be thriving in the community. We plan to be here. We're doing the best that we can statewide. We are also offering services on the neighboring islands as well. And I think we do the best that we can with whatever challenges come. You know, during the time of COVID, we had to regroup and all hands were on deck trying to make sure we could be there for the community with rental assistance. And it was the same with the Maui fire. So we continue to adjust and adapt to whatever the community needs.
And then how much federal funding do you rely on?
Well, I want to say we're probably at about 30% of the funding that we have comes through, whether it's direct assistance. We also have veterans programs, and so that's directly federal contracts. But we have other federal monies that come through state contracts. So we've been assessing all of that and making sure that we have a strategy going forward in case there are any changes in funding. But we feel sure that we will be able to address whatever comes our way. You know, in final thought, this is the Aloha State, where, you know, we're a community of love, we're a community of connection, and I think all of us are doing good work in our own way, but it's really important for all of us to join together in a united way, to look at a plan for our entire community, to make sure that there's room for everyone and everyone can thrive.
All right. Well, thank you so much for carving out time for us today and helping us get to know a little bit more about Catholic Charities.
Thank you so much, Catherine. Thank you for this opportunity.
We've been hearing from Tina Andrade, the new president and CEO of Catholic Charities Hawaii. She assumed the reins from Rob Van Tassel, who recently retired. It has been quite a week for the Hawaii Alliance of Nonprofit Organizations. This morning, Hano and the National Council of Nonprofits met with the state's nonprofits to discuss policy updates and the potential implications for businesses. Among the top concerns are housing stability, food security, and disaster recovery under the Trump administration. We sat down with Melissa Miyashiro, the CEO of Hano, to talk about the uncertainty ahead.
It's been a whirlwind of a week, and things are still changing, so we're still trying to sift through conflicting information, but it has been heartening to see the nonprofit organizations coming together, figuring out how we can organize, how we can stay connected, and sharing information and resources. Absolutely need to do that for the road ahead.
I know, but did you imagine that when you took this job, it would be so chaotic like this?
I didn't necessarily expect this level of chaos, but I certainly knew that I would be stepping into a world of, you know, these social challenges converging. That's very much the time that we're in. That's part of why I was interested in stepping up into this role at Hano, because Hano is really a glue that helps to connect nonprofit organizations. And it felt like a really important opportunity to support all of the incredible community work that happens in Hawaii.
Yes. And this week was a real test, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And we're still in the process of, you know, digesting lessons learned and thinking about how we can, you know, strengthen our lines of communication as a sector, because there's still a lot of uncertainty that remains, and there will still be more issues and orders and different actions coming out of the federal government in particular that we'll need to mobilize and connect on.
I know that nonprofit groups have relied on federal and state funding to provide the services to our community that are so needed, but this administration has ideas on how best to spend the money to support our communities. And maybe, you know, some of that money may not flow as freely as it did before.
Yeah, that's the fear being felt throughout the nonprofit community locally and also across the country. In response to the memo that announced the funding freeze, we saw a lot of, frankly, outrage across the country. And I think that speaks to recognition of the critical role that nonprofits play in our communities across party lines. You know, these organizations are providing critical public services across education, healthcare. Nonprofits just touch so many aspects of our lives, and people really came out in response to voice that. And that was at the heart of a lot of the outrage that we heard.
You know, and we often hear about how the workload is growing, but that budgets may not be necessarily. And so you've got to be creative, you know, with fundraising, or just, you know, fall on your knees and plead mercy and just say, hey, we really need this funding. If you need to do X, Y, and Z, we just can't do it with the dollars that we've been provided.
Absolutely. And that's something that we, you know, advocate for at the state legislature, and also just a conversation that we want more visibility on. At Hano, we think a lot about, of course, the people that in communities that get served by nonprofit organizations, but also the people that work in nonprofit organizations. So nonprofits are also employers that employ our neighbors and our friends and our family members. And they're an important piece of our local workforce that also, you know, need care and attention. And so we want to make sure from Hano's perspective that we're also supporting the people that work in these critical organizations.
So are we doing anything different for this next year? Or, you know, what's the blueprint going forward?
Yeah, I think we're continuing to engage at the state legislature. So this week, there was a lot of attention, understandably, on things happening at the federal level. But the state legislature is still an important venue for, you know, driving change and supporting communities. So we continue to be engaged in that process. One thing that we're doing is continuing to be active in the True Cost Coalition, which is a coalition of over 70 nonprofits that are advocating really for, you know, just what we were talking about, to have fair government contracting and to really reflect the total cost of doing business as a nonprofit. So that's an ongoing conversation. We'll continue to be engaged in the legislature at the state level and having conversations about how we can support nonprofits with funding and other resources,
so
too.
So do the bulk of the nonprofits and, you know, get their monies through the grants and aid?
It really varies. Nonprofits are so different. That's an important source of funding. Some nonprofits contract directly with different state agencies to deliver key services. And then also nonprofits raise funding through, you know, membership dues or other, you know, private sources of grants. So it's really varied. And having a diversified, you know, revenue portfolio can really help nonprofits stay resilient as, you know, there's fluctuations in government funding.
So as you've been talking with the other agencies, this was a big shakeup this week, but that concern hasn't gone away that somehow the federal funding will be cut, if not through this way of this pause and freeze, some other way.
Yeah, we want to stay connected and vigilant on what's happening and as things unfold. One way that we're doing that is to try to get a sense of what's actually happening locally and what local nonprofits are experiencing. So there's some survey work that's going to be, you know, happening soon to just get a sense of who's being impacted and in what ways, so that we can really get clear on those impacts, so that we can have conversations with state leaders, with our congressional delegation about how this is impacting everyday people and everyday communities.
You know, we hear a lot about affordability, but I imagine, you know, it's the same, you know, whether a family or a nonprofit, your power bill is still going up, the rent is going up, and yet the demand for services is growing.
Absolutely. And we're seeing just more and more need for nonprofit services, especially with, you know, increased natural disasters. We really saw in response to the Maui wildfires, you know, that rebuilding effort is still ongoing. There are, you know, chunks of that funding that come from federal government sources. So there's a lot of uncertainty about how we are going to ensure that the sector is resilient to be able to respond to these increasing needs.
And then you help provide training for nonprofit execs or folks, you know, the staff that are really out there doing the work.
We do. We have a program called the HANO Fellows Program, which I really love. It's actually open right now for folks to apply, and it is open to new executive directors. So those that have stepped into a leadership role in a nonprofit within the last 5 years. And we saw a need to really support leaders at this stage in their journey, because nonprofit work, for all the reasons we've been talking about, it can be really exhausting. And executive directors have so much on their shoulders in, you know, being employers, also having to fundraise, also having to be subject matter experts in their mission focus. So it's a big job. And just like in government and even the private sector, we have concerns about the workforce in Hawaii. And we want to make sure that we have people contributing to nonprofits and that want to work in nonprofit organizations, because we know that we need these critical services.
Right. So wherever you can help strengthen the skill sets of the administrators, I mean, that's what you do.
And also provide a peer network of support, because it is a tough job.
So gosh, I mean, as you then just reflect back on the events of this week, anything you want to leave our listeners with that's top of mind for you?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about the importance of the sector and the role that nonprofits play in our communities. That was emphasized tenfold over the past week, and it was just a reminder for all of us that we need to work together to make sure that our communities are supported and that the values that we cherish here in Hawaii, you know, continue to be a part of the conversation and a part of how the work unfolds here.
Okay. Any other hopes for 2025?
I love working in the nonprofit sector because it's powered by heart-driven people. And I love working in Hawaii because community is at the heart of what we do. So working alongside incredible leaders who want to make a difference and care about people and humans gives me a lot of hope.
All right. Well, Melissa, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And that was Melissa Miyashiro, head of HANO, the Hawaii Alliance of Nonprofit Organizations, talking to us about the whirlwind week we've had as groups across the country were in turmoil with the federal funding freeze that was ordered by the White House and blocked by a federal judge. And now it's time to press play on today's Backyard Quiz Answer. Earlier, we asked you to name the rock and roller whose hit Susie Darlin' topped the 1958 U.S. Billboard charts at number 5. As the story goes, Robin Luke was a teen still attending Punahou when he recorded the hit in producer Bobby Bertram's Honolulu bedroom. The nearby bathroom served as an echo chamber. Upon release in May of 1958, the song would receive massive airplay from Hawaii stations. As luck would have it, the honeymooning couple, Art and Dorothy Freeman, heard the song while in Waikiki. They were national distributors for the Dot label and helped introduce the single to radio stations on the continent. The song's popularity carried it to the top of the charts, which also led to a quick U.S. tour and national television appearances on American Bandstand and the Perry Como Show. That was his only hit, and fame proved to be fleeting. By 1965, Luke retired from music, stating he'd never envisioned pursuing music as a career. He pivoted into business and marketing. And our winner today, Ari from Manoa, had the fastest fingers. We had lots of calls, including a new Luke's neighbor, apparently, who recalled when that song was recorded in the bathroom on the first take. So that's so awesome. But thank you so much, everybody, for calling in. That is our quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for HBR comes from Ulupono Initiative. By investing and partnering in local food production, Ulupono supports Hawaii's farmers and ranchers who help reduce the risk of wildfires through land management and stewardship.
This happens to be Catholic Schools Week, and the diocese is winding up with its annual Catholic Schools Conference happening today at St. Patrick's in Kaimuki. A longtime educator is being honored at the event. Deborah Gibo has been a teacher for 50 years, 40 of those at Holy Family Catholic Academy, where she still works today. Gibo serves as a liturgical coordinator and teacher mentor. She joined us in studio earlier this week, and we asked her to take us back to the first day that she walked into the classroom at her first job.
My first teaching job was in Sacramento, California, and I was one of a team of three coming out of the University of California at Davis. It was our first assignment, but the three of us became like one teacher in the classroom. That was the program that they had there at the university. But the school that I went to decided that they were going to split the three of us up and put us in a classroom of 4th, 5th, and 6th graders so that the different groups would be smaller sized. So now with the four teachers that were already assigned to that pod, Now we're adding three more, so there were seven of us that spread the wealth, so to speak.
Wow. But I don't know, when you think back of those early days, did you imagine that your career would stretch out over these many decades?
Well, you know, I always wanted to be a teacher. I don't know if it was a dream or not, but I always wanted just to teach. And it never was any other career field that I was interested in. As I grew older, I was interested in law, but I thought, well, I don't want to go through that. So teaching has always been there. So when I first started, I was where I wanted to be. It was difficult. You know, those first years are always difficult.
And then you taught the younger grades.
When I was in California, I started off with a fifth grade, moved to a second grade, then went back to this school that had a 4, 5, and 6 combination. And then I moved here, couldn't get a teaching job right away, didn't know anybody, went to work at a small private school called Navy Halekeiki, and I taught kindergarten there for 3 years, and then moved over to Holy Family. So I've been in education over 50 years.
Right, and 40 of those at least.
At Holy Family.
As you look to see what has changed, I mean...
Oh, like, yes. I mean, children nowadays are a whole different breed. This is the age of satisfaction for these children. They need to have immediate satisfaction, immediate response to everything. Everything is there because, you know, they're the generation that is into video games and all that, and they get that kind of response back right away.
Yeah, that gratification.
So we have to somehow find a way to reach them so that they stay attuned to what's going on. I mean, I can remember in days gone by where, you know, you could teach a 45-minute class and the class was all attentive. It just doesn't happen that way anymore.
So the pressure's on for you to make it interesting and keep it fun, yeah, and yet nourish their minds.
Yeah, we have to engage our students more so now than ever, them personally, make them a part of their educational process. And once you get them involved, then you've got them. And, you know, they're ready to learn and to do what, you know, is expected of them.
And then I don't know what the rules are at Holy Family, but as far as the use of cell phones, I mean, are the children allowed to bring phones into the classroom? Are they off?
I mean, they have phones, but they can't come out of their backpack. Every child in the school, kindergarten through eighth grade, has an iPad. They belong to the school, but the school issues them at the beginning of the year. And so a lot of our programs are done on the iPad. We make use of Google Classroom, and all the teachers are trained and to use it effectively. We try and get them involved as much as we can with using the technology.
What hasn't changed in the classroom, do you think, just about the kids' maybe love of learning? I don't know.
Basically, children, they want to learn, but you have to give them the opportunity to feel good about what they're learning. You know, is this important to them? Is it something that interests them? But they're there to learn, and they enjoy, most children enjoy going to school each and every day.
And so now, do you remember a teacher that was very impactful when you were growing up?
I had nuns.
Me too.
And I do remember my eighth grade teacher, Sister Anne. She was a little on the younger side compared to most of the nuns that were at the school. And so you could relate to her a lot more. And you always felt that she understood you.
I remember a Sister Anastasia. She was a stickler. She taught math and chemistry, and things had to be very precise. But one of her fabulous things that she passed down to her students is we had to keep all of our tests in a folder. So we had everything organized so that when it came time at the end of the year, we had everything there to go over. But just her organizational skills were tremendous. And just those kinds of, you know, that discipline that mm-hmm. you try and impart on a child.
You may not remember what the capital of a certain state is, but you do remember certain things about certain teachers and how they treated you, you know, how you felt being in their classroom.
As you then look back on your career, what stands out?
Probably the child is important, and because it's a Catholic school, we try and get the children to better understand their role as Catholics in this world and the mission that Jesus has given us, you know, as individuals, whether you're a 5-year-old in kindergarten or a 14-year-old in eighth grade, that, you know, we're here not only for ourselves, but for others. And that our school does that quite a bit.
You know, I just came across my report card from third grade. And the worst grade I had was in religion. But, you know, I mean, how do you see, you know, religious classes in the schools? Has it changed very much?
It just really depends on the school and in what direction the school wants to go to. One of the programs that I initiated at Holy Family is called Walk with Jesus. And every year we focus on a different aspect of Jesus. This year it's his parables. Next year it'll be his miracles. And then each month the teachers teach about a certain parable, like the one coming up is the Good Samaritan. And they teach their religion classes about it. And then we have our fourth through eighth grade students are assigned to the lower grades, preschool through three. And the students go in and now teach the younger students the same things that they learned and do activities with them. So it makes religion come to life more because, first of all, they love their buddies. They love the children that are coming in. And sometimes it's better than a teacher standing in front of the room and giving a lecture of any kind. So we involve our children as much as possible in religion.
So it's really almost like a sibling helping.
Yes. And then we have monthly masses in which different classes are responsible for putting together and creating reflections and meditations and things like that. So that's once a month.
And then you are in a position now where you help to mentor teachers.
Yes.
So talk about that.
Okay. Basically, I work with those teachers who are either new to education, new as a teacher, and I've had some of those, or new to our school. And I work with them for approximately 3 years. It's like a graduation, and then they move on. But we work on a lot of things. We work on writing effective lesson plans to engage students. We work on classroom management skills, because especially with the newer teachers, sometimes they're just discovering the best way to have classroom management. And sometimes it's just a hit and miss. So you got to try, see if it works. If it doesn't, try again, see if it works. So I work with them in establishing routines, programs, using the curriculum that the school has adopted into the most effective way.
Well, you know, we interviewed, I believe it was the Teacher of the Year last year from the Big Island, and the students just love the way that he brought things from outside the classroom into their world, and that just really resonated with him. And so he was just constantly on the prowl looking for things that would just jazz his students, you know, about, you know, learning.
Well, I can remember one thing that happened while I was a third grade teacher, that I wanted the children to really love reading, no matter who's reading to them or whether or not they're reading to themselves, and that reading can go on forever, you know, even as you get older. So I had what I called a mystery reader. I invited, and the following people showed up at my classroom to read my class. Mufi Hanneman when he was mayor, Ariyoshi's wife when he was governor.
Yes.
Frank DeLima came. I don't know if you remember Jasmine Trias.
Oh, yes.
She was a student at Holy Family,
oh,
and
nice.
Her sister was in my class. So I would invite these people in to let them know that, oh, and the bishop was another person that came in. So to show them that, you know, reading isn't just what you read in the classroom, that, you know, you have to develop a love for it, and it's going to be there if you just attempt it and try it.
If you can get them excited about reading, yeah, that's just, it's going to stay with them forever.
Or I would invite the parents to come and be a mystery reader, and the child would have to introduce the parents to the class. And I mean, it was just something that I did to ignite that love of learning.
Anything else you want to share with our listeners just about how you help to mentor, you know, the up-and-coming teachers?
Well, first of all, I think it was last year or the year before last. At the end of this week, we have what we call the ACCE. That's our annual conference for Catholic educators. And that year, we happened to break up into sessions, and I was in a session where it was a round table, and you just sat around and you talked about what you did, and you had to introduce yourself first and what you did at the school. So when I introduced myself, these teachers are going, how did you get that started? We need that at our school. We need that. You know, it's something that all teachers need at some point in time. They need to step back and reevaluate, see what they're doing. And that's what I do with them. We sit back and we talk. Sometimes we don't talk about the curriculum that they're teaching that week. Sometimes we talk about a student and the best way to help that individual student, or the frustration that they might feel that they don't think they're getting everything taught. So it's almost it's open-ended. Whatever the teachers come in to want to discuss, that's what we go into. And I try and provide as much information as possible.
And as you think about the students that have come through your doors over the years, I don't know, any fun stories that you can share just about kids' love of learning?
My own children went through Holy Family, kindergarten through the eighth grade. They did want to go on to schools like Punahou, Iolani, and I told them, I said, you know, I'm sorry, but Mom already is through paying tuition. You're going to public school. And they did. My children went to public school and did well, came out with four-year scholarships. And I'm very pleased, but they made a lot of, one of the things that Holy Family does is that the friendships that you make in elementary school sometimes don't last. But my daughter and my son still have friends that they see and talk to. And I think that's what's unique about our school, because it's small enough that you don't get lost in the crowd. You know everybody. Everybody knows you. You move on. You go through the grades together.
Yes, lifelong friends.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that spirit that you nurture, that Holy Family gives, I guess that's priceless.
The children seem to love the school today. Our prayer service started off the week. So the students in the classroom are writing cards and letters to students in the Pacific about what's going on in their lives and things like that, and then they'll trade. We have another activity this week, which is the Heart Challenge, where the American Heart Association comes out, and it's kind of a fundraiser we do for them. And you usually get about $10,000 a year to donate to the Heart Association, but the kids are all involved in it. It's all about them. It's not about anybody else. We'll have a teacher swap, so a teacher will go into a different classroom and experience those children while they experience, so that the students in the school get to know everybody.
Yeah, so that's the secret, right? You get them engaged and on
definitely,
their toes.
Definitely.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure getting to know you. And I hope you stick around for another 10 years.
Oh, I know. My children keep asking me, Mom, when are you going to retire? And I go, what am I going to do? I enjoy going to work every day. You know, as long as I'm not stuck, like, I left third grade because I was ready. I was ready for something new and different. And who knows where I'm going to go next.
That was Deborah Gibo, a veteran educator in our community who dropped by our studios earlier this week. She has been a teacher for 50 years and for the last 40 years has been at Holy Family Catholic Academy. Gibo is being honored today as part of a celebration of Catholic Schools Week across the country. The theme this year is United in Faith Through Community.
Don't know much about geography, don't know much trigonometry, don't know much about algebra, don't know what a slide rule is for, but I know that one and one is two, and if this one could be with you, what a wonderful world this would be.
Well, that's it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we'll take a closer look at the immigration snapshot here in the islands as Homeland Security begins the Trump administration sweep now happening across the country. What do you think about the roundup of undocumented immigrants? Weigh in. Call 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation podcast on Spotify or Apple or on our website. Our program is produced by Lillian Song, Maddie Bender, and D.W. Gibson, with help from Troy DeJournay and Savannah Harriman-Pope. Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.